Welcome to the MUFG Global Markets Podcast. I'm John Cook, and I'm joined today by George Goncalves, MUFG's head of U.S. macro strategy. It's Wednesday, May 26th, 2021. Welcome to the podcast, George.
Thanks, John. Really excited to be here.
Yeah, excited to have you. So, George, you recently launched your macro platform with your inaugural piece entitled U.S. Desk Strategy, Macro to Market, Our Framework, and Latest Forecasts. Why don't we start the podcast by taking our listeners through your process?
First off, John, I want to say it's great to join the ranks of folks like yourself, as well as all our other colleagues across the securities business, and more broadly on the bank side in the U.S., as well as being part of such a premier name like MUFG out of Japan. So for the benefit of our listeners for the first time hearing me, I just recently joined MUFG Securities in the Americas to spearhead the development of the bank's U.S. fixed income views and market strategies through leadership and specific trade ideas for clients. So I thought it'd be helpful, as you mentioned, I just recently published this note, it'd be helpful to produce a framework note for both existing as well as future clients to get a glimpse of how I look at the world. So let's jump into that. The macro strategy world has been evolving over the years, but really there's some core tenets of what drives overall strategy when you're looking at it from a macro lens. And so what I've been perfecting over years through various techniques and studies, I've been looking at creating analytical tools, databases that help pinpoint what's driving markets, what's driving also on the other side, central banks, and how does that all relate to asset allocations and specific trading strategies in different regimes, and really using that to look for key catalysts, what sort of risks are associated to the macro outlook, and looking for inflection points in markets that could present potential opportunities for trades and for a reallocation of portfolios. The overall approach is grounded in economic fundamentals, as it typically is, and market technicals as an overlay. We leverage a tremendous amount of data and historical time series analysis, what's priced into the economy, into the markets, and we try to compare that and contrast that to historical patterns to understand where we are in the cycle. But more specifically, I've taken my process and continue to fine-tune it over the years, and I use what I kind of call a four-pillar approach to perform market analysis specific to fixed income assets. But as we all know, all markets are connected. I can apply this lens to any asset class, and I do so many times to understand the relative value between bonds as well as other asset classes. But these four pillars primarily are the traditional kind of global macro, understanding where we are in the growth and inflation cycle, central bank views, identifying regimes and narratives that are commonplace and how do they compare to history. The second pillar is quant technical based. It's going through a number of metrics over the years of how markets are evolving, different relationships that are commonplace in different regimes, and slicing and dicing through that data to develop even more derived data and unique filters to come up with actionable views on specific markets. Pillar three and pillar four are kind of related, but also one's quantitative, one's qualitative. But I do believe that there's still, even though we live in a world that's very much algorithmic and there's a ton of data and you can predict a lot of things, you still need to have the human factor and understand and interact with clients and serve as like an information broker to get a sense of what investors are thinking to help formulate and educate your view. And so I do think that a combination of both private-based survey data as well as public information and just understanding sentiment and tracking all of these indicators gives you a view into behavioral finance and how markets are set up, and it ties back to this idea around narratives. And then pillar four, the positioning and flows, is really how, just really following the money and actually seeing how investors are putting money to work and how those positions and flows are changing over time to identify trends. And when you put all of that into a blender and you kind of think through where we are in different cycles, you can come up with trading strategies where we are fixed income folks, we will focus on really the four kind of quadrants of risks that impact all fixed income portfolios, which is your view on duration, your view on curves, spreads, and volatility.
Thanks, George. That was helpful. Now that we understand the process, why don't we explore the view? U.S. growth and inflation seems a reasonable place to start. What's your outlook here? And also, what are the upside and downside risks to that outlook?
So right now, I would characterize that the U.S. is still in the boom phase of the recovery. We're going to probably post one of the strongest quarterly GDPs for Q2. And with that, we're seeing a higher impulse on overall inflation as well. And so the growth and inflation intersect, if it were to continue like this, and if we were to extrapolate forward, we would have one of the strongest recoveries. And it's easy to understand why many are dubbing this new decade that we're in a repeat of the 1920s, roaring 20s, right? And so on a snapshot perspective, if you look at where things are, yeah, growth is phenomenal. We're coming back, though, from a pandemic. And so there's some shortfalls on how things are actually progressing. But the actual numbers themselves look amazing. And, for example, the Bloomberg median consensus estimate for Q2 is roughly 9.4. And even for Q4 of this year, it's like 4.8. Like, we have not seen those sort of numbers really since post-war period, going back to the 1940s and 50s. And so it's understandable to feel excited about this boom type phase. The tricky part, however, is that a lot of this has been built on fiscal stimulus and just a comparison from a very low point last year. And so we're of the view that a lot of the sort of fiscal stimulus, a lot of the overall just liquidity and the wealth effect that has also helped with overall consumer spending has pulled forward aggregate demand. And there's a real risk that in the second half of the year, maybe more towards the end of the year, we'll probably see a decent deceleration from these sort of levels. And even the fourth quarter estimate by Bloomberg consensus economists of 4.8 seems a little bit too high, and more likely we're going to end up with lower growth than that. And I think that's going to be a little bit of a shock for markets. The markets are starting to feel that out, I think, and we're seeing that a little bit priced into more so in the bond market than other risk assets. But I think that's one piece of it. On the inflation side, similarly, because of supply shortages, because of restrictions around COVID-19, production cycles throughout all economies have been impacted tremendously. And so you're seeing just bottlenecks and disruptions in the process, and that's adding to frictions, which is introducing more inflation. However, on this case, I'm generally in agreement with the Fed's assessment that these inflation pressures that we've been going through are most likely temporary, transitory, and really based on one-off factors. So it's an environment where we're transitioning from a really good high-level growth period to a more of a trend growth period over the next 6 months to a year, and it's going to be hard to calibrate exactly where we are in that cycle, and I think that's going to cause for a lot of opportunities as well over the course of the summer and into the fall as markets have to reprice that.
So I think what I'm hearing here is some downside risk to the consensus GDP forecast, particularly at the second half of the year. Whereas in contrast, sounds like you're pretty confident the Fed has inflation right. It is transitory, and that dissipates, a little bit later on. So speaking of the Fed, this is a nice transition. From our day-to-day conversations, I know you're still in the process of fleshing out your view on the Fed. And I suspect, and hope, that we do a podcast exactly on the Fed in the near future. Still, I was wondering if you could give us a sense of what you're thinking, even if it is just at a very high level.
So we have the upcoming June meeting, and we have had a series of updates along the way with the most recent Fed minutes from the last meeting, presenting the possibility that a number of Fed FOMC participants are thinking about now. We're getting close to a time in the upcoming meetings to think about a plan for tapering. And so that's one of the big focuses around the Fed. The other key piece, which we'll be focusing on too in the coming weeks, and it's been also a hot topic, is what's happening in the plumbing side of the money markets with the reverse repo. And in many ways, the two of them are kind of attached at the hip through the increases in reserve balances that we've been seeing as a result of both the $120 billion per month of QE, as well as disbursements coming from the Treasury as stimulus is now making its way through the economy, and the Treasury takes down cash from the general account at sitting at the Fed. It's really introducing a lot of liquidity and potentially maybe even disruptive to the Fed's own objectives of trying to keep Fed funds very stable and above the zero bound. Meanwhile, it's the Fed's own actions around QE and all these reserve growth that's kind of aiding and abetting that. So they're kind of in a tough spot there. In many ways, that argues for tapering, not just for the mechanical reasons, but the economy is obviously getting better. Inflation risks are now higher than they were before. So even though we feel it's transitory, there is a risk that we're wrong, including the Fed. And so as we progress through time, they might end up finding out that inflation is more sticky and they might have to accelerate on the tapering side. So I think, you know, where we are now is it's still the wait and see mode, rethinking, planning, and we'll be over the course of the summer hearing more from the Fed about how they're going to execute their taper. I am of the view that, you know, this taper will be different than the prior taper. And that's one of the reasons why I believe that long-term rates will not necessarily have to have a massive next sell-off in rates, that we're not going to see a repeat of the shock that we saw in 2013 into 14 of higher rates because the Fed's reduced liquidity. And in fact, what we found through this cycle, it's been other financial assets that have benefited probably equally, or if not more, from all this excess liquidity, even if it's just from a narrative perspective. But there is signs of how liquidity gets into broader markets, that if the Fed starts pulling back and signals that they're going to pull back, that just the sheer fact of a market correction or a minor adjustment on valuations and other asset classes would help keep a lid on long-term rates in the U.S. because that would trigger some flight to quality type flows. And so, you know, we think that, you know, the forecast on 10s and 30s will not be as challenged going forward. There it still has an upward bias, and the Fed, you know, will be tapering at some point, potentially sooner than what consensus is. And as I kind of start to put pen to paper and organize my thoughts, we'll do a part two. But I do think they're getting closer, and part of it is mechanical, part of it is the inflation and the growth outlook, and they need to slowly, gracefully get out of this whole QE business. On the rate cycle side, that then maybe brings forward the hiking cycle. The bond market and overall short-term rates have been also trying to feel this out, and we've had moments of higher short-term rates in the money market strip. But you know, we're not necessarily looking for a hike in 2022, but in the earlier part of 23, in the first half of 23, the Fed could very well be at a point where they're hiking rates. The key difference for us, though, is that just like the tapering will be different, the hiking cycle will be different, and they're not going to embark upon a campaign to take rates up to their long-term objectives. They'll probably have a number of pit stops along the way.
Yeah, thanks. You know, you talked a little bit about this, you know, the interest rates, but, you know, as it pertains to the Fed, and this stuff's obviously all interrelated, but let's spend a little bit more time there. So what are your outlooks for growth, inflation, and the Fed, and how do those outlooks influence your view on the path for interest rates? And again, let's talk about the front of the curve and the longer end.
So I think, so I, in the next two quarters, I take the stance that you need to be flexible because we're about to transition from a pretty fast growth trajectory to a much more trend growth environment as we get into 22. And on top of that, we have a number of potential risk events over the course of the summer, and markets outside of the bond market, well, outside of the treasury market, are on the more rich side. And so I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this next two quarters, it's going to be hard to necessarily pinpoint where we'll end up. But I do think we have another scope for a rally. We're in the midst of one now. I think this is not the major rally that could happen over the summer if we are going to see any sort of disruptions or risk off environments. But there is still scope for treasuries to rally down to 1.375, maybe even 1.25 on a really kind of more negative environment in the summer. On the flip side, what we've identified in terms of the upper bounds of like 1.825 and that, you know, psychologically important 2% level on the 10-year, I think provides a lot of resistance for how high rates can go over that same window. So we're kind of, you know, broadening out the range a little bit of possible outcomes. I still think that there's going to be one bullish move before we have another bigger bearish move, but it won't necessarily surpass the last highs that we saw of 175 by much. Maybe we get up, you know, 12.5-25 basis points above that and get towards 2%. But to meaningfully go above 2% and get back to where rates were before, even way before the pandemic, we need the Fed to start to hike. And this is what we've seen time and time again. We've seen multiple false dawns on second stage sell-offs, and they don't necessarily last for too long, and then we rally back down. So, you know, we've been in a range trade for about 2 months. We'll see what the Fed does in the next couple of weeks. We'll see what NFP does, more importantly, as I think that will influence some of their decisions, as well as the market. And if we get back up towards 165, 175, that could be the near-term top for the summer, and it'll be hard to go way beyond that unless we get, you know, an environment where we're off on the growth outlook for, you know, the fourth quarter, first quarter of next year. And if the economy continues to do well and it's organically and the Fed is pulling back on liquidity, that's when it could actually create an environment where we get a meaningfully above 2%. On the very front end, it's going to be hard without the Fed actually raising rates. But there is, as I mentioned earlier, some of these technical wonky stuff that are happening in the plumbing of the money markets. And if we continue on the path that we've been on for the last really month or so, but really this last couple of days, we've seen more and more usage of the reverse repo program, the RRP, where it's draining liquidity and investors that are flush with cash are depositing money at the Fed and getting treasury collaterals in, as a way to park their cash. If that were to continue to increase and go above $500 billion, which the high side was north of 400 recently, if we get meaningfully above 500 and if we start to see short-term rates go even lower towards zero, I think that has also been having an influence on overall yield grab across the fixed income universe. If the Fed were to tackle that either intra-meeting or at the actual June meeting and raise short-term rates, it's possible that we get a little bit of a sell-off in the front end. And that also triggers a further sell-off in long-term rates because they're all connected.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think if I'm not mistaken, we had 46 counterparties taking, you know, $450 billion just today. So that's something, we're pretty close to that $500 billion threshold that you mentioned. So all really good stuff, George. Really looking forward to having you back on the podcast to discuss the Fed a little bit more detail in the coming weeks. And thanks for joining us.
Great. It's great to be here. Thank you, John.
Thank you for listening to the MUFG Global Markets Podcast. Rate, review, and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And reach out to your MUFG sales rep for any further information. Check back soon for more insights from the Global Markets Research Team.